Thanks to our sponsor, Malloy Law Offices. They are a personal injury law firm here in the local DC area that helps others recover from car accidents, work injuries, slip and fall injuries, and other types of accidents. They work on what's called a contingency fee basis. So if you hire Malloy Law Offices after an accident, then you never pay anything out of pocket. They also offer educational content and free consultations for those who have more questions than answers, like us at DC by Foot. We're really excited to partner with them next month to learn all about personal liability as a tour guide in Washington, D.C. Visit their website at malloy-law.com or call their offices at 202-335-6141. Malloy Law Offices is open 24/7, so don't hesitate to get the right legal help you need after a personal injury accident.
Everyone, welcome to Tour Guide Tell All. We're your friendly neighborhood tour guides here to share with you the often scandalous and interesting sides of history. We are back at it this spring. It is April, and we are so excited to bring another episode to you. Before we jump in, as always, I'm Becca.
I'm Rebecca.
And together we're
the Rebeccas.
And it is spring. We are here. We're in full tour guide mode. We certainly hope, as we always say, that you'll come and take a tour with us. We've got tours running pretty much 7 days a week, morning, noon, and night. Check it out at dcbyfoot.com. This is a great time of year to be in Washington before the heat settles in the summer. So if you're thinking about making a little escape, don't let the spring crowds scare you off. It's still a great time to be here. Big thank you, as always, to our patrons. Our patrons really make this podcast happen. We're so grateful to you for keeping the lights on, keeping this rolling. As always, patrons get a special bonus episode every month. So if you're not listening to those, you are missing out on some fun topics. We get a little more like, I was going to say unhinged, but that's not right. So even more unfiltered in our patron episodes. So if you really want to get the tour guide tell all, the full experience, consider becoming a patron for as little as just a couple dollars a month. You can get access to those special bonus episodes. So I'm excited about our topic today. I feel like it intersects with a lot of things we've talked about and touched on, and yet we've never really delved into this particular phenomenon and this particular person. So I'm really excited because I feel like there's a lot of cool like overlaps and intersections, but also it's crazy. We've done this for 4 years and we haven't talked about this particular figure.
I know. So we're going to talk about the circus. Not Congress. Sorry, had to do it. Okay. No, we're going to talk about the actual circus, like Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey type stuff, specifically one part of that, which is the Barnum part. Let's chat about P.T. Barnum.
And look, I'm just going to jump in and say that if you've seen the Hugh Jackman Greatest Showman on Earth or whatever movie, there's no historical, very little historical evidence to that. So I'm sorry to disappoint you. If you, like me, have belted out "This Is Me," it's a great song, Hugh Jackman's delightful, but we're really about to blow your mind about the reality of P.T. Barnum.
Yeah, they seem to take some dramatic license with any number of things.
A lot of dramatic license.
Yeah. So the real P.T. Barnum also did not look like Hugh Jackman. Let's just spoil. I mean, few humans do, honestly. So he's born in Connecticut. Yay! The PT stands for Phineas Taylor, which that's a name.
What a great time for names.
I know. If I had that, that was my name, I would go by my initials too. I got to be honest. he's born in 1810 in Bethel, Connecticut. He starts out running several small businesses in town. By the time he's in his early 20s, he has a general store. He set up a statewide lottery. He has a newspaper. He's got like stuff going on. He is very clearly from like the jump, a man on the make. He wants to do things, and he's book auctions and real estate speculation. And some of these seem fairly above board and legal. And some of them, slightly less so, I think. And he is going to get sued. Some local church elders sue him, and he's incarcerated briefly. So that he starts another newspaper. It's a whole thing. And he's going to start his career as a showman. He sells his store when he's like 24 years old, and he starts his career as a showman at the age of 25 and moves into showbiz. And we're going to start with a woman. This is sort of how he makes his mark. And this is not a great story, just so that we're here for that first. He starts with a woman named Joyce Heth. Yeah, this is a little gross, so just FYI. Joyce Heth is a blind and mostly paralyzed former slave. So this is 1830s. Slavery is still legal in the South. We have not fought the Civil War yet, but it is not legal really in most northern states, especially Connecticut and New York. And so what he is going to do, he's going to basically use a legal loophole to essentially rent out her services. It's not great. She is billed to him as George Washington's 161-year-old former nurse. Which, math is not my strong suit, but 161 seems...
You don't even have to go that old. That, here's what really gets me with the flim flam already is that George Washington would have been born in the 1730s. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't have to even go that old in this time period. You could have said that she was 100, like the whole 161 is so ridiculous. And yeah, to make it clear, he leases her the way perhaps you might lease a car today, yeah. For $1,000, which back then, I mean, that's not a good chunk of money now, but in the early 1800s, that's a lot of money. And he actually takes out a pretty sizable loan to do this. And he writes this quote later, but I think it kind of gives you a little insight into his mind, where he basically sort of says, I knew that I could succeed. I long fancied that I could succeed if I could only get hold of a public exhibition. So he's been looking for something that he can monetize, troop around, and put on display. So that's his impetus for getting involved with this woman, and really has no, he doesn't even pretend to have a more noble cause.
No, he does not. There's actually something about Barnum that's almost like the grift is out front and open. He's not really trying to hide it in so many parts of his life. He is going to lease her, borrowing about half to complete this the lease. And he then forces her to work between 10 and 12 hours a day. And she gives basically work 6 days a week. And essentially, he works this poor woman to death. She's not 161, as it turns out, but she's not a young woman either. She was blind and partially paralyzed, and the hours just really kill her within months. She dies in February 1836, about 80 years old, they think. And she's not done, unfortunately. Barnum has not finished exploiting this poor woman, even though she's dead. He is going to host a live autopsy to prove her age. So he essentially charges money, about 50 cents, which is pretty dear in the 1830s, basically in a saloon to demonstrate her actual age before paying spectators, which is gross.
Yeah.
A lot gross, really terrible. And if you're starting to suspect that Barnum might not be the hero here, you might be right.
And neither is Barnum the hero, but I think it's worth noting that immediately he finds an audience for this.
Yes.
People are eager to take part in this. So he is certainly not the hero, but there's also no real limit to, or no lack of audience for him. And even members of the press, particularly New York, seem to be really excited about these grotesque displays. Certainly there is some criticism in the press, but a lot of the interest and curiosity outweighs any of the handful of editorials that kind of go, hey, this feels unseemly. So he's hitting into a moment, yeah, too, where there's starting to be a little bit more mass culture and mass consumption, and people are looking for spectacle. They're looking for something, right, to capture their attention. So he's not the hero, but neither are the people who pay money to line up and see this woman either.
No, and I think that that's important to mention about Barnum. Like, he's an innovative showman and marketer, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. And he has like the ability that he has to capture an audience is really profound, but there is an audience to be captured, right? Like, if he wasn't making money doing these things, he wouldn't do them. That's the kind of person that he was. This isn't about a cause for him. This is about money and lining his own pockets. And he's pretty upfront about that, to his credit. The thing is, he's doing really rough stuff, but there's also people are paying him like a lot of money to see this. So he is supplying a need that is very real. The other thing that characterizes Barnum's life is he goes through boom and bust cycles like several different times. He will be very successful and make a lot of money and then lose a lot of money really fast. So this continues to happen over and over again. And this is going to be one of those times he does not manage to capitalize on the money he makes from Joyce Heth. There's a panic the next year, an economic panic, and it takes him a little while to recover. Eventually, he purchases a museum in Manhattan. It's called Scudder's American Museum, but obviously he is going to rename it Barnum's American Museum. And this becomes 1842, he purchases this and upgrades it. So he's going to add all kinds of really great features to this, and it becomes the, like a show place, right? And it's a he adds a lamp, like a lighthouse, that's going to attract attention all the way up and down that area of Broadway. There's flags that attract attention and paintings of like animals. So basically advertising what's on offer inside. The roof is transformed to there's like daily hot air balloon rides on the roof of this museum. It's really cool. He adds all sorts of things. It's a museum the way that we think of a museum with like exhibits, but it's also there's live acts and curiosities and stuffed animals. And he has detailed models of cities with famous buildings. And like you can see the cross section of a palace in Europe because that's not something that most people could go see at that time. So he also is going to then get, he's got giants, little people, albinos, magicians, quote unquote, exotic women. So that's the part that gets a little bit more gross, I think.
And to give you an idea of the scale he's operating on, he had within his collection at its peak over 850,000, 850,000 what he called curiosities. And again, this runs the gamut from what you might see in a natural history museum today, skeletons and taxidermied mammals and things, to, you know, these kind of dioramas and models, to living human beings and living human creatures, including a man that was really named William Henry Johnson, but who he claimed was a mixture of wild native African and a kind of monkey man. And he simply said, the sign said, for want of a positive name, the creature was called what is it? So you've got this sort of mishmash of all these things, and there was so much of it. For 25 cents, imagine you're a New Yorker, life is hard, you work hard. And so for 25 cents, you can go to this place that has all sorts of things, including things and people that maybe hit that uncomfortable part, but there's some excitement in that as well. He hits into this kind of human nature, and it is. 25 cents was not nothing back then, but it was accessible for the average working person. And so he understands that you're working class, you're looking for a little entertainment. He can provide that, and he can provide it in a way that will make you keep coming back for more. And it's just, to me, the scale of it is so overwhelming when you think about what's in a museum today. You know, 825,000 individual curiosities is a lot. And then the number of visitors he's attracting, sometimes 4,000 a day. Coming to this museum and to gawk at these people, living people.
There's a lot about this that's gross, but the gawking at the human spectacle is really like just, and this is not unique to Barnum. This is not unique to this time and place. Like we talked about this with our 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. Like this is a popular thing. Anything that is regarded as exotic, which seems to be anything that's not white and American, is put on display like people in are in a zoo themselves, and it's really gross. It is not as gross back then. I don't know how better to explain it, but this was sort of part of, but I don't want to like excuse it because it is really awful, but this was very much normal entertainment. Barnum is by no means the only person who's displaying people in a sort of live human zoo at this time. He gets into hoaxes too. His first major hoax is what they call the Fiji mermaid, which is a creature with the body of a monkey and it basically the torso and head of a juvenile monkey sewn onto the back half of a fish. Which isn't super gross, I guess, as far as it goes, but still kind of creepy. And he also is going to form a relationship with a guy named Charles, a little kid named Charles Stratton. So when he starts his relationship with Charles Stratton, Stratton is four years old. So he's a kid. He's almost like a trafficked child, really. And he's a dwarf. And Barnum bills him as 11-year-old General Tom Thumb. And this is so wrong, friends, just wrong. Stratton is a little kid. He's taught to imitate Napoleon and Hercules and so be the big general. And so he can be General Tom Thumb. And he will travel around with Barnum for years. This is a very successful venture for P.T. Barnum. He puts a lot of money into Tom Thumb. It becomes a really big and important deal. And they go to Europe together. They're together for a long, long time. Within like 4 years, this museum is attracting 400,000 visitors a year. So it is an immediate and lasting success. And it's so successful that Barnum is worried that people are staying too long because there's so many things to see and do in his museum that they'll stay inside the building all day, which obviously he doesn't like because that means you're at capacity. You can't let other people in, which means revenue is going to go down. So what he does really cleverly is towards the end of the exhibit, he puts up a big sign that says this way to the egress. And everybody says, oh, look, there's more to see. And they like follow the signs to see the egress, not knowing that egress is actually a fancy word for exit. And so they get out the door and it, of course, locks behind them. And they're like, oh, that's it. That's a bummer.
A way of hustling people through.
Yes. And if you want to go back through, like if you weren't done, you then have to pay again. So this is his way to get people to move through his museum in a faster kind of way, which is honestly kind of genius, really. He also has a relationship with a woman named Jenny Lind. Jenny Lind is an opera singer. She's known as the Swedish Nightingale. And she is already famous. And Barnum is not musical. By his own admission, he doesn't understand or particularly care, but he knows that other people do. And so he is going to ask Jenny Lind, offer her the chance to sing on a U.S. tour. He's going to pay her $1,000 a night for 150 nights with all expenses paid. And Jenny Lind, not being a fool, demands the money in advance. And she actually uses a lot of this funds for charitable causes because Jenny Lind actually is a really important and good person. He is short of money. He has to persuade a minister that Lind would be a positive influence on American morals. And so the minister lends him money, the final money he needs to pay her. The contract also offers her the option of withdrawing after a certain number of performances, paying Barnum some of that money back if she does. And she's already a celebrity. And so this tour makes Barnum back his money in like a week. He makes a ton of money really fast. And it's beyond successful. He recoups his money times by like a factor of four. Like he makes a lot of money doing this. And one of the things about this that's really interesting is, and we all know this, but we don't know this. In those days, there's no recording. So you can't hear this woman's voice before you go to hear it. If you want to hear a concert, you go to hear the concert and that's the last you're ever going to hear of her. You can't buy the CD and bring it home with you. So you have to go and like pay attention. This is a big deal. And that's sort of why this woman sells so well is that she has this really lovely voice and people want the experience of being in the hall to hear her singing. And it's a really big and important, there's the press gets a hold of this, public enthusiasm, they call it Lind Mania. Jenny Lind becomes an even bigger star.
She's exotic in a different way in that she's Swedish, she's European, she's lovely, she's gorgeous to look at with this gorgeous voice. And because she's adored on the European circuit, there's, I think, a sense for many audiences here in America that as we're striving for a little more sophistication, as we're kind of veering towards our 100th birthday as a country, right? This is sort of about 20 years before that. There's this idea of like, we want to be more cultured and educated and sophisticated. And she really represents that. And Barnum makes a very, very savvy investment on Barnum's part because he makes so much of this money back. She makes, by most estimates, about $13 to $14 million in today's money doing this tour. And essentially, it's about a year's worth of work. So imagine locking down $13 to $14 million in about a year's worth of performances. I mean, that's how big she was. And if she's making that, Barnum's making even more. So it is hugely, hugely successful.
And the Hugh Jackman movie basically seems to imply that there's a romance between Barnum and Lind that is completely fabricated. There is no evidence that they had a romance at all. So just to mention that. And anyway, Barnum has journalists on his payroll. So there are journalists that go around and write press releases and the whole thing about Lind to sort of burnish this tour, and it's a smashing success. Barnum then decides to move into the theater because he's had success with Jenny Lind. He's going to keep going. He wants to reform the theater from its seedy reputation. So theater at the time is not super great.
Yeah, we've touched on this a little bit kind of leading up to the Civil War era. But yeah, you know, people want entertainment and there's people willing to pay for it, but it's usually considered the theater a lower kind of form of entertainment, especially if you're not talking about concerts and opera, you're talking about kind of comedians or melodrama. The kind of women that get involved in this, right, are considered little better than women of ill repute. So it's considered a place where, you know, people go and drink and get into trouble. And so Barnum thinks, I can come in and I can make the theater better. I can make it a little more respected. I'm going to put the Barnum shine,
yes,
on theater.
And he kind of does. One of the things that he does that's really savvy is he starts the practice of matinees, afternoon performances, because he knows that will attract families, offer more family-friendly fare. Barnum was a teetotaler. He didn't drink. And so he's going to offer lectures about temperance. He offers a play that's basically a thinly veiled tale about how drinking is terrible for you. And so that's really going to appeal to families. This is a time when the temperance movement is very much on the rise in the country. He's going to bring in melodramas. He brings in Shakespeare readings. He edits works of literature, like, for example, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is a really famous book at that time. He's going to edit that down to like render it family friendly, essentially, so that people will come to see it. He organizes flower shows and dog shows and beauty contests and Shakespeare readings and baby contests, which is weird.
It is weird to think, like, I remember playing Monopoly or whatever, and there's like the card if you like win the baby, you know, baby, because second place in the baby contest. Like, yeah. He pioneered that, yeah. But that was a thing that would remain popular into like the early 20th century of let's parade our babies around and decide which one is cutest.
Yeah, it just seems
most appealing.
Just weird, deeply weird. Yep. Mm-hmm. He actually makes a bunch of business loans. He tries to develop parts of his home area in Connecticut and is going to develop that area and use a lot of money to do it. He creates America's first aquarium, which is cool. And he expands the wax. He has a wax museum at part of his museum collection. He has the seven wonders of the ancient world. You can walk through and see a version of what they would have looked like. And the museum remains popular and profitable throughout the American Civil War. He then hires a former spy during, like, in the midst of the war, he hires a former spy to come and talk about her adventures as a spy behind Confederate lines. Who knows if that's all real or probably slightly embellished, but he does it anyway, makes a lot of money at it. Barnum is distinctly pro-US. He is very much a patriot. And so he is going to, his very strong stance for the United States is going to incite a Confederate sympathizer to start a fire in his museum in 1864. It burns to the ground completely a year later from a fire of unknown origin. And then another fire in 1868 basically wipes it out. So again, like, we got this boom and bust cycle. He had been booming, and now he kind of heads down. He's in a bust, the bust part of the cycle. So this becomes something. And by this time, Barnum is in his 50s. He's an established, settled man. He's got kids. He's not a young man anymore. And to have these sort of boom and bust cycles is really a whole lot. He then decides to go into the circus.
Because why not?
And he runs for Congress. No, I'm just kidding. He actually does run for Congress, but
unsuccessfully.
Not at this point. No. He serves two terms.
But his first time running is unsuccessful, or earlier into his career.
And he likes it so much, he starts the real circus. Ba-dum-bum. Okay. He is basically going to start a circus. It's part circus, part menagerie, and part freak show. So he's going to essentially take the idea of his museum and, like, make it mobile.
Put it on the road. Take it to the people. The country is booming right after the Civil War. We're expanding west. Not everybody can make it to the museum in New York or into a city to find these attractions. And so Barnum recognizes that there's a huge audience out there that he can reach if he goes to them. And he is sort of, there is, I think, you know, after the war, he has an understanding that people are looking for levity and entertainment. In fact, he would write about after the war that men, women, and children who cannot live on gravity alone need something to satisfy their gayer, lighter moods and hours. And there is this sense of, like, hey, we've been through something pretty rough as a country. Let's have a little fun, and I'll bring it to you. I'll come to you. And so he's going to these rural communities and smaller towns that had never, you know, might have read about Barnum in the paper, but had never even seen anything close to what he's taking on the road. And again, it shows his innovation. It shows his savviness. While he is, I think, a complex figure, he's so ahead of the curve in understanding, like, where people are at and what they're willing to spend their money on. Their precious, limited, spare coins is on something fun and entertaining and exotic and different.
I love the idea of this moving around to people too. I love that he understands that, like, people want to see something nearby their hometown, and that not everybody has the money to go to New York. And this is a way to reach people. And he's just such a savvy and really brilliant marketer. His approaches to attracting audiences are so innovative for the time. The Barnum Circus becomes a success, and he partners eventually in 1881 with James Bailey, and their circus becomes Barnum and Bailey's. So yes, that particular circus. He is there the first circus with three rings. So the three ring circus, that's his innovation. Basically three places for action. And you don't, like, having been to the circus, you don't know really where to look. There's so many things going on. It's so many things trying to wow you all at the same time. His primary attraction at first is an African elephant named Jumbo. Jumbo becomes kind of a big deal. He has a traveling menagerie, including acrobats and freak shows and Tom Thumb. And he's going to continue to grow the circus despite all kinds of disaster. There are fires and train accidents and the whole thing. There become people whose job it is to run his circus. Like, this, you get the idea of circus performers who become professionals by doing this. It is possibly the first circus to move by train. And Barnum is probably the first person to own his own train.
Which I believe, right? He's got money to spend, and he's got to move this around, and you might as well invest in your own train to do it.
Sure. He is considered the Shakespeare of advertising because of his genius marketing. He calls it the greatest show on earth, which I guess it is, kind of. He also writes, and this is the part of Barnum that's really interesting. He also writes a series of books. He writes about temperance. He's a strong advocate for temperance, so he worried about that. He also becomes a debunker. And we talked about this a little in our spiritualism episode. We talked about this a little bit with Harry Houdini. There are a number of people trying hoaxes, and Barnum seems to be really interested in debunking a lot of hoaxes, spirit photographers, things of that nature. And so he will spend a lot of time and money. Basically, he writes a book about this to debunk a lot of this. And he seems to really enjoy walking the line between like hoax and fraud, which is great.
And it is sort of fascinating because he has dabbled in essentially, you know, a little bit of flim flam, a little bit of misdirection of presenting things as they were not, essentially perpetuating hoaxes upon the American public. And yet he's got such an interest in sort of debunking these people who he thinks are fraudulent. So it is really fascinating that he sort of finds himself critical of others, particularly as it involves these fake spiritualists, while he is also not above telling a few little white lies and spinning a yarn if it's going to be good for business. So it's one of those fascinating, I think, aspects of his mind where he can sort of draw a line for himself of being on the non-hoax side and everybody else on the other.
And he also becomes increasingly concerned with animal welfare. Like he joins a bunch of, devotes a lot of money to it, joins a couple of different causes supporting animal welfare. I think seeing how animals are treated, he makes sure that the animals in his circus are treated well. And I think that that's a really kind of admirable aspect to his sort of circus life, is that he wants to make sure that the animals are well treated. He gets into politics. We actually weren't making that up. He really does get into politics. He is staunchly Republican. He is anti-slavery from back in the day, which is ironic given that he makes his money exploiting essentially a former slave. But he is elected to the Connecticut General Assembly, the state assembly. He is then going to get elected to Congress, serves two terms in the 1860s. He vociferously supports the 13th Amendment. And he is going to serve in the Connecticut legislature. He then becomes mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut for four terms.
Yeah, he really, it's not surprising to me, right? Politics is show. I mean, so much of it is showbiz. And he really fits right in. Obviously, he's a good speaker. He's a good promoter. All those things are very good assets if you want to run for government on any level. If you want to be mayor, you got to be a good glad hander. Same with the state legislature and Congress. He's perfect for that. But he actually has a genuine interest, I think, too, in making the country better. You're talking about his loyalty to the United States during the Civil War. He considers himself deeply patriotic. He befriended a number of politicians throughout his career and wrote admiring letters to quite a number of presidents and members of Congress. He once wrote that it always seemed to me that a man who, quote, takes no interest in politics is unfit to live in a land where the government rests in the hands of the people. So he felt it was really important in this country that people be willing to get engaged in their local communities and local government. And he takes it really seriously. He accomplishes quite a lot during that time, particularly when he's mayor. He is going to lower the utility costs. He's going to improve the water supply, clean water supply, and he's going to close down the city's houses of ill repute in Bridgeport, because he is not just a teetotaler, but really kind of interested and adamant about communities being welcoming and safe for all, including children. And that's part of what I find interesting about his museum and then the circus, is he really feels like he's presenting very family-friendly fare, that what he is putting out there for the consumption, you don't have to worry about being assaulted by indecency, is like one way that he describes it. I think we can look back at some of the things and some of the people in which he is going to put on display and find some indecency there, but he really sees himself as the father of this like family friendly entertainment. And he brings that mentality to his time in government, where he's really a little bit of the like morality and decency guy. Like, I'm here to clean up our town.
Yep. I like that about him. He gets involved in a lot of philanthropy. He calls it himself a profitable philanthropy. Basically, by improving their area of Connecticut, they can add to the pleasure and prosperity of their neighbors, and the incentive, they'll basically spend money at my places. So he basically wants to make things better for everybody, essentially so that they can all be spending money at his places. He gets appointed to the board of trustees for Tufts University right before it opens, and gives them several significant contributions. And in gratitude, they are going to name their mascot after Jumbo the elephant. And to this day, Tufts University are the Jumbos. They have an elephant as their mascot, thanks to P.T. Barnum. His personal life is, you know, he marries young, has four daughters, which bumps him out a little bit. He doesn't have a son to carry on the name. So eventually he's going to leave a clause in his will that he wants one of his grandsons to inherit if the grandson uses Barnum as part of his last name, which is very, that's a whole thing. One of his daughters he cuts off because she commits adultery and is otherwise sort of not particularly moral, and he cuts her off. And then his wife dies fairly quickly, or fairly suddenly, I should say. And within a year, he marries the daughter of a friend of his. Her name is Nancy Fish, and she's 40 years his junior and is in fact younger than his children. So this raises some eyebrows, I would imagine. They seem to have a very happy marriage. They're married for the last 15 years of his life. He dies at home in Connecticut at the age of 80. And in fact, his last words, a showman until the very end, his last words were to ask about the circus receipts at Madison Square Garden that night. So like he's concerned about this really right up until the end. He is buried in a tomb in Bridgeport, Connecticut of his own design. He also was treated in a hospital in Bridgeport, Connecticut that he significantly funded. So he was really, he did actually do some good for the area. And the museum that houses his curiosities still stands in Bridgeport. In fact, it is, as you would expect from P.T. Barnum, you can identify it instantly because it doesn't look like it belongs. It's like you're driving along the highway, and I've seen it many times. It's got weird turrets and like Russian domes and just looks totally out of place in like a modern American city. And you can immediately tell like, oh, that's Barnum's museum. So it is still there and still open. Have been, in fact. Barnum's legacy is, I would say, mixed. I would go the mixed legacy on P.T. Barnum. He's a really brilliant innovator and advertises in a way that I think is going to really lay a lot of groundwork for what comes later. Like, I think he's really sets up the stage for what comes after him, sort of the modern age of spectacle and the modern age of advertising. He's not a particularly good guy, as we kind of alluded to, but he also isn't, he's not forcing these people to see his curiosities at gunpoint either. He's clearly satisfying a need that people already have. And he is doing it bigger and better than I think anybody else does or would. But I feel like Barnum is, if the interest for people had not been in human zoos and human sort of freak show exhibits, I feel like he would have gone in another direction. Ultimately, to him, it wasn't about.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that at the time of his death, I mean, he's one of the most famous people in the world, right? The Washington Post literally says the most widely known American that ever lived. The obituary that's written in London says that he's a showman on a grandiose scale. I mean, when he dies, there's sort of these tributes all over. He's known so widely that I think for a long time, he's just known as this big figure, this celebrity. And it's really only, I think, more recently in the last sort of 40, 50 years that people have started to look a little bit more deeper at what that legacy is built on and what that fame is built on. And there was, I think, a level of exploitation that goes on, but there was somebody willing to pay for that too. And so I don't lay it all at Barnum's feet. I think there's a sense too of he's the first guy to kind of tap into the fact that at the end of the day, people don't mind being tricked a little bit if it's for their entertainment. They don't mind. They don't mind looking at the things that make them a little uncomfortable or a little squidgy, because it's also fascinating and fun. And it, as much as he's sort of this like morality guy, it does tap into that like naughty part of your brain of, I know that it's not great that they've got these El Salvadorian children in a cage pretending to be Aztecs, but I'm fascinated by it. And I find it really intriguing. And he taps into that part of human nature. And again, thousands and thousands and thousands of people are willing to turn over their hard-earned money to have that experience. So it is, he's fast. He's so interesting to me because he's so big. He's so successful. He transcends kind of one thing, right? He's going to be famous for many things in many places and many time periods throughout the 19th century. He's so on the forefront of so many things that I think we think of as classically American. marketing, sales, entertainment. These things are so core to American identity. And yet, of course, so core to American identity is building it off of debt and exploitation and misdirection and misrepresentation. And so he's right there in that. But yeah, I look forward to someday maybe somebody making a movie that delves more into the reality of Barnum. So much of what's out there pop culture wise. And I say this, I like The Greatest Showman. It's a fun flick. Hugh Jackman's very enjoyable and Zac Efron's great. Everyone's great in it. But to me, it's like not a historical look, really. And most of even the TV movies and films and Broadway shows and things that have been made about Barnum really tap into the showman aspect and the birth of big American entertainment and the circus, and dabble less in these kind of conflicty parts and the gray areas of him. So someday maybe we'll get things. And there's been so much great scholarship in the last few decades that I hope that in the future, maybe we get a movie or a miniseries that digs into that trickier side.
Right. And you can also see a direct through line between him and like Harry Houdini, that era. There's a direct, you know, the idea of human spectacle doesn't go away. And I think that there's there's, you know, definitely modern representations of that as well. It looks different now, but humans are fascinated by spectacle. We're fascinated by the odd and the slightly off-putting. And I think Barnum sort of instinctively understood that. One other thing I would like to debunk, the phrase that's most often associated with him, there's a sucker born every minute. Apparently, he didn't coin that phrase. I've done a bunch of research and it seems there's some people who give him credit for it, but most people suggest that he did not come up with that.
Yeah, my guess is probably not, actually. I would go with that based on my research, but also just a feel of Barnum. Sucker doesn't sound like something he'd say, right? Humbug is sort of the word that gets tossed around a lot with him. But that said, it is a very true statement. There is a sucker born every minute.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's why you can, even though if he didn't say it, that's why you can like, you totally see him saying it. It's a thing, you know, like it's a truism.
It is a truism, but I actually feel like it does not feel like something Barnum himself would have said.
No.
Really interesting topic, Rebecca. This is just one that I'm so glad that we had a chance to really touch on and debunk a little bit, but also kind of explore all, you know, I sort of forget how often he loses money and comes back and loses money and comes back and just reinvents himself, right? It's not just the museum or just the circus or just the theater. It's all of this and politics and philanthropy all at once. So a really interesting topic today.
Yeah. And thanks for coming along with us, friends. We'll be back with more and stay tuned. And thank you for your support and for listening. And let us know if you want to hear something or have reactions or questions or would like to just tell us something. We're always here to listen to you. We are on the socials at tourguidetellall@gmail.com. Send us questions. We love to hear from you. Thank you guys. And we'll be back with more.
Thank you guys so much. See you next time.
Bye.